This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, October 9th, 2007. From KBCS in Bellevue, Seattle, this is Yuko Kodama. In today's program, the opposition is calling for a recount of Costa Rica's national referendum on the Central American Free Trade Agreement. Is Code Pink making an impact in the halls of Congress? And today marks the 40th anniversary of Ernesto Che Guevara's death. All this and more, but first, these news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. Turkey is threatening to invade Iraqi Kurdistan as early as today. The announcement of a possible military incursion comes after suspected Kurdish rebels killed 13 Turkish soldiers on Sunday. Authorities in the relatively peaceful region of Iraqi Kurdistan have for months been reporting a buildup of Turkish forces along the common border. In other news, the Supreme Court has refused to hear the case of a victim of the CIA's extraordinary rendition program. German citizen Khalid al-Masri says he was kidnapped by CIA agents while on vacation in Macedonia, flown to Afghanistan, tortured in a detention center, then dumped in an Albanian forest months later with no explanation or apology. The Supreme Court issued no statement when it dismissed al-Masri's appeal today. The move upholds a lower court's refusal to hear the case on the grounds that it may expose state secrets. An Ohio utility company has agreed to pay billions of dollars to reduce toxic emissions from more than a dozen coal-fired power plants in the Ohio River Valley. The Environmental Protection Agency calls it the single largest environmental enforcement settlement in U.S. history. Evan Davis reports from Columbus.
The record settlement is the result of an eight-year-old lawsuit against the Columbus, Ohio-based utility company American Electric and Power, or AEP. The company had agreed to spend several billion dollars installing emissions control equipment on a number of its aging coal-fired power plants in Ohio, Indiana, and West Virginia. The suit, brought jointly in 1999 by a coalition of environmental groups and the EPA, accused AEP of violating the Clean Air Act by failing to reduce emissions of nitrous oxide and sulfur dioxide, two pollutants known to cause acid rain and a litany of other health concerns. Catherine Turser is with Ohio Citizen Action, the lead plaintiff in the suit.
All corporations are going to have to start thinking in a clear way about the economic bottom line of making it harder to breathe.
Although AEP denies breaking any laws, the settlement does include a $15 million civil fine and another $60 million in mitigation costs. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Evan Davis in Columbus, Ohio.
Canadian military forces in Afghanistan have started paying the salaries of Afghan police directly in cash, completely bypassing the Afghan government. Stefan Christoph reports from Montreal.
The decision to pay Afghan police salaries directly has raised criticism in that it could undercut the already limited authority the Afghan government has in the context of the ongoing NATO operation. Canadian military officials argue that the move is not to compromise the legitimacy of the Afghan authorities, but to bypass corruption within local governments. Canada currently plays a major role in training the Afghan National Police. Anti-war activists calling for a full troop withdrawal say that putting Canadian troops in charge of police payroll only further entrenches the six-year-long occupation. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Stefan Christoph in Montreal.
The United Nations is hosting diplomatic talks to reach an international agreement on the Arms Control Treaty. Heather Risby reports.
More than 150 countries support the resolution to adopt global rules and regulations to contain the international flow of guns and other small weapons. The only country that opposed it was the United States, which has more than a 35% share in the worldwide small arms market. Proponents say an effective treaty on arms trade would help prevent violations of international humanitarian law and other serious abuses. According to the Small Arms Survey, a research group based in Switzerland, about 25% of the $4 billion annual trade in small weapons is either illegal or not recorded as required by law. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Risby at the United Nations.
Mexico appears to be on its way to once again ranking as the hemisphere's most dangerous country for media workers. Vladimir Flores has the story.
Unknown assailants opened fire on three newspaper vendors yesterday as they traveled on a major highway in a truck belonging to the Oaxacan daily El Imparcial. All three of the newspaper vendors died from multiple gunshot wounds to the head. Motives for the attack are unknown at this time. The newspaper reports that its managing director received an anonymous phone call hours after the attack telling him, quote, "You are next." The ambush occurred in the Isthmus of Tehuantepec, an area heavily patrolled by both police and soldiers in the context of a large operation to combat organized crime. For FSRN, I am Vladimir Flores in Oaxaca City.
And finally, the second court martial of conscientious objector, First Lieutenant Aaron Watada, has been put on hold while a civilian court weighs a constitutional challenge. Watada's military trial was scheduled to open today, but a federal judge in Washington state halted the proceedings to consider Lieutenant Watada's double jeopardy claim. The lieutenant's petition argues that the second court martial violates his constitutional right to not stand trial twice on the same charges. His first court martial on charges of refusing deployment and conduct unbecoming an officer ended in a mistrial earlier this year. Those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
In yesterday's CAFTA developments, a national referendum in Costa Rica was held on the Central American Free Trade Agreement. Currently, the yes vote on CAFTA is leading with 51.5% of the vote, and the opposition is calling for a mandatory recount. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice today addressed members of the Council on Foreign Relations and pressured Congress to ratify free trade agreements with several Latin American countries. In Washington, D.C., Naji Mujahid has more on Rice's story.
Speaking to the Council on Foreign Relations today in Washington, D.C., at the Organization of American States, Condoleezza Rice spoke about the free trade agreements that have been made with Colombia, Peru, and Panama. She spoke of the necessity that Congress ratifies these agreements so that they can be actualized. Condoleezza Rice.
What is at stake is the success of what I will call today our Pan-American community, the vision of a hemisphere of independent nations living in liberty and prosperity and peace, which U.S. leaders of both parties have nurtured since the founding of our republic.
The United States signed these agreements with Peru, Colombia, and Panama all within the past 2 years. Critics who reflect back on the 1994 North American Free Trade Agreement with Mexico and Canada say these new pacts will bring about similar results. Dr. Gabriela D. Lemos is the executive director of the Labor Council for Latin American Advancement. Lemos offers this response to Condoleezza Rice's assertions that the FTAs would further the cause of democracy in the region.
From a democracy perspective, there have been countless resurgences of indigenous movements against trade agreements, and particularly in Mexico, for example, the Zapatistas, but with other indigenous groups as well, because these trade agreements do not help them in the long term.
Having had 13 years to analyze NAFTA, one notable criticism refers to the over 1 million Mexican farm livelihoods that were destroyed as a result of the post-NAFTA economic landscape. These new economic conditions created problems for American workers as well. As noted by Mark Weisbrot of the Center for Economic Policy Research, NAFTA had devastating effects on the wage levels in the United States.
These types of agreements, NAFTA, the WTO, and this whole strategy of deliberately forcing down wages in the United States, which is really one of the main purposes of these agreements, this strategy has become increasingly unpopular in the United States as well.
The Peru Free Trade Agreement, with overwhelming support, easily passed the Senate committee last week and is expected to pass the House committee soon. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Naji Mujahid of the D.C. Radio Co-op.
The Nepalese parliamentary vote scheduled for November 22nd is delayed indefinitely. Maoist rebels are demanding the government abolish the monarchy and hold elections for its parliament with a fully proportional voting system. The former Indian Foreign Minister Shyam Saran will be sent to Nepal in hopes of negotiating a new deal between the Maoist rebels and the Nepalese government. PC Dubey reports from Kathmandu.
The Nepalese government released a statement on October 5 stating that they were indefinitely postponing the November 22nd parliamentary poll because of what they said was an unpleasant atmosphere between the rival political camps. Lakshman Vatrai for the Nepalese Election Commission on Nepal Radio.
I'm announcing the postponement of the election at the behest of the Nepalese government.
The Election Commission's announcement is testing the patience of a wide cross-section of Nepalese people who say they have lost faith in the country's politicians.
We are unhappy that the poll has been postponed indefinitely.
Now we won't trust the politicians. They always betray.
Madhav Kumar Nepal is General Secretary of the Mainstream Communist Party of Nepal, a partner in the current seven-party Nepal government. Nepal expressed anguish at the postponement of the poll, blaming the Maoist rebels for hindering the country's move towards a full democracy.
The Constituent Assembly poll is a must to build a new Nepal. The postponement only prolongs the age of monarchy. It will fuel anarchy, directionlessness, and uncertainty in the country.
The parliamentary poll was actually selected to be held in June, but it was cancelled because the interim parliament could not pass requisite legislations to conduct the election and the new date was fixed. Pasupati Shamsher Rana, president of pro-monarchy National Democratic Party, has said that the parliamentary poll's postponement has ended the legitimacy of the government in the eyes of the international community.
Who is responsible for such a betrayal? None. But the entire seven-party coalition is collectively guilty for it.
Surya Bahadur Thapa, an ex-premier and chief of another pro-monarchy National People's Power Party, has said that the delay in the parliamentary vote was due to the power struggle among the current seven-party government and said worse things could occur if the crisis is not mitigated.
The country's politics are moving in an unbalanced way, so it is very much certain and natural that political accidents like dictatorship could be triggered off.
Shekhar Koirala, a relation and close advisor of Prime Minister Koirala, says the Prime Minister's main concern in delaying the vote was to preserve the seven-party unity and the peace process.
He has still not said anything, but it won't be surprising if he resigns.
Parliamentary leaders like Prakash Sharan Mahat also blamed the Maoists for being inconsistent with their behavior since joining the government and interim parliament early this year. But Baburam Bhattarai, the senior Maoist leader, has dismissed such allegations. He has said that if the parliamentary poll were held last June, they would have not raised the twin demands of abolishing the monarchy and changing the system to proportional representation. Rebel leader Bhattarai.
The recent mass movements of Dalits, women, tribals, and Madhesis are demanding an election based on a proportional representation system. The people won't allow the electoral poll if their demand is not met. So we are asking for it only to ensure the election without any bloodshed.
Prachanda, the supreme leader of the Maoists, has conceded that they were ready to relinquish their demands in order to find a way out of the crisis. He has hinted that a referendum on the abolishment of the monarchy could be a way for the Maoists to rejoin the government, which they quit early September. Meanwhile, some analysts are optimistic that the Maoists will reach an agreement with the seven-party government because they accomplished their goal of delaying the parliamentary poll. From Kathmandu, I am PC Dubey for Free Speech Radio News.
On Sunday, 23 Egyptian newspapers did not go to print. The papers struck in protest against the crackdown on press freedoms by the Egyptian government. The move follows the sentencing of seven journalists in September to prison on charges ranging from misquoting the justice minister to spreading rumors about the ill health of 79-year-old President Hosni Mubarak. Aya Batraoui has more from Cairo.
In an unprecedented move made to send a message to the Egyptian government, 22 independent and opposition newspapers did not go to print on Sunday. The newspapers did not publish for an entire day to protest what they called the fierce campaign against the free press in Egypt. The protest comes at a time when 11 journalists, including five chief editors of the most popular and widely read independent newspapers in Egypt, were arrested for a brief period fined 20,000 Egyptian pounds, or about $4,000 each, sentenced to at least 1 year in prison, and put on trial. Their crime, the government says, is publishing rumors about Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak's health. The health of the nearly 80-year-old president serving his 26th year as president of Egypt is a touchy subject in a country where there is no vice president and no clear successor. Dr. Naila Hamdi, a journalism professor and media expert in Cairo, believes that a lack of press freedoms in the region has led to self-censorship among journalists. But despite the arrest, the Egyptian media is in transition and moving forward, she says.
The arresting of the editors-in-chief is really notable because it's considered a setback. But it doesn't mean that it is, you know, the end of media freedom or changes or transition in Egypt. I think it is just going to be one of those things where you go back a little and then move forward a little.
Khaled Salah, a chief columnist for the independent newspaper Al Masri Al Youm, explained why his newspaper felt it necessary to take part in the strike and not publish for one day, even in the face of financial setbacks.
So the strike was very, very important to send a message to the government that we will not continue as a decor to decorate their forged democracy. And it's a message also for the public opinion that the journalists will never give up asking for more freedom.
Despite the setbacks to freedom of the press in Egypt, I asked Salah if he feels safe criticizing the ruling party. He had this to say.
We are not Syria. We are not Iraq during Saddam Hussein. There is a dictatorship in Egypt, but it's also working by rules. They have to go to court. But on the other side, there's a lot of fears now of criticize the president himself.
While the struggle for greater press freedoms continues, the decision not to go to print for one day was a united message by the independent Egyptian press that they are fighting back and still very alive. Reporting from Cairo for Free Speech Radio News, this is Aya Batraoui.
Israeli police announced the arrest of a group of teenagers they call a neo-Nazi cell. The teenagers are all Russian-speaking immigrants. The arrest has prompted a public debate about Israel's immigration laws and the failed assimilation of some Russian immigrant youth into Israeli society. Daniel Estrin reports from Jerusalem.
The picture was on the front of newspapers and the top of TV headlines. Six youth with their arms outstretched in a Heil Hitler salute. In a leading Israeli daily, the picture was accompanied by one word, unbelievable. This video was put together by members of the gang. It documents their attacks on foreign workers, religious Jews, drug addicts, and gays, and it's set to a heavy metal soundtrack. Police spokesman Mickey Rosenfeld says that they confiscated many of these kinds of videos.
We in fact also confiscated weapons that they'd used in their attacks, knives, clubs, as well as other materials, even TNT, which they had somehow managed to get hold of, which we believe that at one point or another they could have used on a larger scale.
It's the first time in Israel's history that such a group has been apprehended. Up until now, Nazism within its own borders was considered unthinkable in the Jewish state, which was founded in the wake of the Holocaust. Even today, there are no laws banning Nazi activities in Israel. All eight of the cell members arrested are Russian-speaking immigrants from the former Soviet Union who came to Israel in the past 5 to 8 years, according to the law of return. That law states that anyone with at least one Jewish parent or grandparent can immigrate to Israel with their families. But in Orthodox Judaism, religion is passed down by the mother. Israel issues many new immigrants with identity cards, classifying them as non-Jewish. Eli Zarchin heads the Israeli Association for Immigrant Youth and is himself a Russian Israeli. He says that out of the 300,000 Russian immigrant children in Israel, some 50,000 are not Jewish.
Non-Jewish means he grew up like non-Jewish. He has never felt any connection to being Jewish, to Jewish people. And suddenly his parents took him from the former Soviet Union and brought to Israel. And nobody in Israel took him into any workshop, into any activities to connect them to the Israeli society, to the Israeli Jewish society.
Police spokesman Mickey Rosenfeld does not attribute the arrests to a wider phenomenon related to the Russian community.
We see this as an isolated incident, an isolated cell. This has nothing to do with the community, the Russian community themselves.
But Eli Zarchin doesn't consider this an isolated incident.
We know about 7-8 cities with such groups. I would not call it single case. We know such group in Netanya, we know such group in Ashkelon, we know such group in Rehovot, we know another group in Petah Tikva.
Zarchin says these groups, like the one arrested, attract youth who slip through the cracks of the educational system. Russian immigrant youth comprise 42% of all dropouts and 36% of all criminal cases in Israel. There are many Russian immigrant kids, including non-Jews, who excel in the Israeli army and at university. Zarchin believes that the small few who do join neo-Nazi gangs aren't attracted because of Nazi ideology, but because it's their way to rebel against a society that failed them.
Jews represent for them Israel. Israel that doesn't like them, Israel that doesn't accept them, and they know that there are several things that make Jews very upset. For example, neo-Nazi symbols. It's our responsibility also, as a community, as a society, to deal with these children.
The ringleader of the arrested gang has a grandmother who is a Holocaust survivor. But she's from his father's side, and so he is not considered Jewish in Israel. Neither is 16-year-old Vitalin Vagin from the southern coastal town of Ashkelon, one of the cities Eli Zarchin claims is home to a neo-Nazi gang. Vitalin's father is Jewish, and in Russia, he was considered the same.
Here, they don't consider me Jewish. I know that I'm Jewish originally because my dad is Jewish, but to the Jews here, I don't really connect.
He's not a gang member, and he doesn't know of any neo-Nazi gangs in his city, but he is one of 50,000 children in Israel who immigrate under the law of return and enter a society that they feel counts them out. From Jerusalem, I'm Daniel Estrin for Free Speech Radio News.
Code Pink, the peace activist group, has established a permanent presence on Capitol Hill. These activists dress in pink, sit in hearing rooms, and speak out publicly against the war, often leading to arrests or being thrown out of the committee room. The group is dramatically raising the anti-war movement's visibility in Washington. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell takes a look at the impact the protesters are having in Congress.
When General David Petraeus testified before Congress in September on the Iraq War, Code Pink activists sat in the audience and at times expressed outrage. The activist group Code Pink are a group of women, distinguishable because of their pink clothing adorning anti-war slogans. And since the beginning of this year, they've become a mainstay on Capitol Hill. They sit in on hearings, remaining silent at times and disrupting them at others. They've occupied lawmakers' offices and have been arrested for their disturbances. They've also been known to stake out members of Congress as they're heading to the House floor for a vote. And what they want is an end to the Iraq War, impeachment, and are against an attack on Iran. Code Pink member Liz Horican is from Arizona.
This is for our kids. We're here because we don't know what else to do. And, you know, we are here for the next generation, for better America, you know, for our great patriotism and the honor that we have to be a citizen in this country. You know, we respect the Constitution, but, you know, it's not easy. Our families say, wow, are you ever coming home, honey?
All of their efforts begs the question, are their actions having any impact? Well, Chair of the House Judiciary Committee John Conyers has indicated he will not bring about articles of impeachment against the president and vice president. As a longtime civil rights activist and Vietnam War protester, Conyers says their tactics are futile.
It's very curious thought how yelling at members of Congress as they go to vote and get on the subway that they ought to do this or that. I keep thinking, who do they think is going to be impressed by that?
And for anti-war Republican Senator Gordon Smith of Oregon, their tactics and their demands are unreasonable.
Obviously, they're not shifting any opinions. They're probably hardening opinions. But I respect their right to feel as they do, say what they say, but I think they could find venues more effective than disrupting Senate hearings.
As for progress on anti-war measures they're pushing in Congress, little has been made, especially since July. The Senate has been unable to garner additional support for withdrawal measures. And in the House of Representatives, Speaker Nancy Pelosi will not bring up the most extensive withdrawal legislation. Instead, she's moved more moderate, planning to introduce incremental legislation that builds consensus and does little to bring the war to an end. But Code Pink is just one part of the anti-war movement that actively works for change. But success could be hard to measure. One thing Code Pink is a constant, visible reminder on Capitol Hill that an unpopular war is raging in Iraq. And it's very possible that all 535 members of Congress knows who Code Pink are and what they want. Again, Senator Smith.
And that's the only difference I have with them, is how we leave, not if we leave.
Jeffrey Stone, law professor at the University of Chicago, says their visibility could outweigh the negative perceptions some could have.
It makes it very difficult to simply go about your business as if there is not something there to pay attention to. And oftentimes when there's an issue that's unpleasant, people don't want to have to come to terms with it. And the very fact that they're there, I think, does mean that members of Congress can't simply ignore the issue.
Code Pinker Liz Horakin admits the progress is slow going, but she says she wakes up motivated every morning.
More people are talking to me. I can dialogue with more people on both sides of the aisle that, 6 months ago, they clearly didn't want to even talk to me.
Code Pink activists have no plans of leaving Washington until they see the change they want. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Today marks the 40th anniversary of Ernesto Che Guevara's death. Che Guevara, an Argentine doctor, joined the Castro brothers' insurrection in the mountains of southeast Cuba and became one of the revolution's top commanders. Years later, he was assassinated in Valle Grande by the Bolivian military while training rebels there. In his famed 1964 address to the United Nations, Guevara suggests that world powers can peacefully coexist, even among states with different economic and social systems. In this excerpt, he accuses the United Nations of betraying the trust of the Democratic Republic of the Congo's first democratically elected prime minister, Patrice Lumumba, who was assassinated 3 years earlier.
How can one forget how the hope that Patrice Lumumba placed in the United Nations was betrayed? How can one forget the machinations and maneuvers which followed in the wake of the occupation of that country by United Nations troops, under whose auspices the assassins of this great African patriot acted with impunity? But the scales have fallen from our eyes, and they now open upon new horizons. And we can see what yesterday, in our conditions of colonial servitude, we could not observe. That Western civilization disguises under its showy front a scene of hyenas and of jackals. That is the only name that can be applied to those who have gone to fulfill humanitarian tasks in the Congo. Bloodthirsty butchers who feed on helpless people. That is what imperialism does to men. That is what marks the white imperialist.
Ernesto Che Guevara in his 1964 address to the United Nations. Today is the 40th anniversary of his assassination. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. Our newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Jackson Ellers. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young. Our DC editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Antonio Ortiz and Puck Lowe. I'm Yuko Kodama at KBCS in Bellevue, Seattle.